Hey, this is The Takeaway, and it's Friday, February 2nd, 2018.
It's The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. Good to have you with us on this Friday. And in Washington, D.C. right now, it's all about the memo. Betsy Woodruff of The Daily Beast will be here in a few minutes with the latest to explain the extraordinary war between the White House and the FBI and what this could mean for an investigation that President Trump wants to go away. But first, to immigration and a policy change that could affect hundreds of thousands of people hoping to gain asylum in the United States. On Wednesday, U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services announced that instead of looking at asylum applications in the order they were filed, they're implementing a last-in, first-out approach. That means prioritizing more recent applications while people who've been waiting for years in some cases continue to wait. And the backlog is huge. More than 310,000 people seeking asylum waiting to have their cases heard by U.S. immigration officials. So what's behind the policy change and what does it mean for people who've been waiting in line for years? Dara Lind is senior reporter covering immigration for Vox. Dara, welcome back.
Good to be on.
Well, Dara, what exactly is the new policy on asylum seekers here? How does it work?
This policy applies to what are called affirmative asylum cases, which is people who proactively seek asylum rather than being arrested and put in deportation proceedings and they're saying, well, I've been persecuted, I need to be able to stay here. So instead of the situation that we've had for the last 4 years or so, 3.5 years, where the cases were processed basically in the order they were received. So the oldest cases were processed first, with some exceptions. It's now kind of the way it's been traditionally, which is this last in, first out. If your application has been received in the last 3 weeks, you'll be the first person scheduled for an interview rather than having to wait the same amount that whoever, you know, is currently in the front of the line had to wait to get there.
So how does that help get rid of the backlog? Because the other 300,000 people who've been waiting are still waiting. What does it accomplish?
The Trump administration is worried that people are fraudulently claiming asylum in large numbers. They're convinced that many of the people who are claiming that they're persecuted aren't really persecuted or don't qualify for asylum under American law. And so their concern is, how do we get them back to their countries as quickly as possible rather than allowing them to stay in the U.S. before their asylum case is ultimately denied? For that reason, they don't want to create a situation in which someone who comes to the U.S. and has a pending asylum case gets to work legally while their asylum case is pending, because you can get a work permit while waiting for that to go through. They'd rather allow the people who are currently waiting for their asylum cases to get approved or denied to be able to continue to work, but not allow new people coming in to get those same privileges.
And in terms of the evaluation of who can qualify for asylum status, is that changing?
It is not officially changing. The United States doesn't have a ton of room here within international law standards of what countries have to do in accepting people who say they're fleeing persecution. What there has been is a kind of tacit or, you know, sometimes rhetorical expectation from Trump and from Attorney General Jeff Sessions in particular that asylum cases are being processed too leniently, especially at that initial credible fear stage. They're not being scrutinized enough, and they're using the fact that many credible fear applications do get approved as evidence that people must not be strict enough about it. So it hasn't yet materialized into any explicit memos or changes in standards, and it's not clear how much effect it's having on the ground. But there is kind of this expectation for people who are on all stages of the process that they should be a lot more, I wouldn't say careful, but a lot stricter in deciding who should be allowed to claim persecution and be allowed to stay in the United States.
Still, you mentioned, Dara, that the Trump administration is essentially returning to a pre-2014 policy here. How did it work back then? Is there a track record?
The underlying capacity problem here appears to be that U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services, unlike other immigration agencies, is largely fee-funded. Its money comes from applications from immigrants who, you know, have to pay processing fees. So when something happens, like a backlog in asylum applications, Congress doesn't just appropriate a bunch more money for USCIS to hire a bunch more people. It could, but it doesn't. The reason that it changed was that the Obama administration had to deal with this increasing backlog at the same time that there was this wave of children and families coming from Central America and mostly claiming persecution when they arrived in the U.S. And for children who come to the U.S. without adults in particular, they have certain rights that adults don't have after getting apprehended. And one of those is that they get to talk to an asylum officer first. They don't have to go through a judge first. So that put another strain on the system. The Obama administration tried to deal with that by saying that children should get preference and everybody else should be processed in the order they were received so that they weren't exacerbating the wait for people who had already been waiting. That's why it changed. It definitely didn't have much of an effect in stemming the backlog. The backlog has gotten substantially worse since 2014, but it wasn't really designed to do that. It was designed to process these kids' cases as quickly as possible. And now the Trump administration has decided that the real problem here is adults who are able to work in the U.S. legally while asylum cases are pending.
So then what's likely to happen here with all those adults, 300,000 or so of them living in the United States, ostensibly working in the United States? Do they have redress? Will they launch lawsuits or will they simply say, well, I guess I can stay and work and at least be safe? And once the government gets around to hearing my case, they'll do it.
Well, the problem here, and this is something that human rights groups are very concerned about, is that while you can work legally in the U.S. while your asylum case is pending, you can't bring your family members over until you have, you know, full asylee status. So people who came to the U.S. fleeing persecution, but whose wives or children are still stuck in their home countries or still in vulnerable situations, are at substantial risk here. And that's in addition to kind of the usual stress that being separated from one's family for a long period of time would put on someone, especially someone who's gone through trauma. So the concern here is, you know, less about the kind of amount of time they're waiting and more that going through that waiting process really does put substantial strain on people, especially if it's happening at the same time that more claims are going to get denied at the end of the process. If you're waiting, you know, several years to hear if your asylum case is going to get approved and then it ultimately isn't, that seems like a massive disruption to somebody's life that the government isn't considering as its primary motivation in making this change, to be sure.
Dara Lind, senior reporter with Vox. Dara, thanks again.
Thank you.
Well, let's turn now from the immigration system in the United States to the immigration system in Canada. In 2017, over 15,000 people crossed the U.S.-Canada border illegally. That number could go up in 2018 as hundreds of thousands of U.S. residents lose their temporary protected status and with the DACA program in question. But Canada wants to make it clear they are not necessarily the place for people looking to leave the United States. They've actually recently sent representatives to the U.S. to discourage people from emigrating to Canada with the message that you might not be allowed in. Vilma Felici consults with immigrants in the U.S. who are considering a move to Canada. She's an immigration consultant at Felici Palacio Immigration Services in Toronto, also a professor of immigration and refugee law at Seneca College. Vilma, thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Well, you know, America is rife with images of people pouring over the border from Mexico into Canada. Is this a phenomenon that people could be viewing in Toronto or London, Ontario as well?
Yes, it is. In fact, people are coming in through the borders in Quebec and Manitoba, and they find their way into Toronto. And so it has already become a problem for the city. We're running out of space to house people coming from the United States and coming from Mexico and other countries to make refugee claims.
Vilma, how many people do you encounter who want to come to Canada from the United States? And who are they typically?
We get a lot of emails and phone calls. I would say between my partner and I, we probably speak to about 30 people a day. And they're typically people that are totally out of status in the United States or people that are on TPS or DACA, and they want to come and live in Canada. Many of them talk about making a refugee claim. Others want to be able to come as federal skilled workers, or they're looking for any other program that would give them a permanent residency in Canada.
Vilma, meanwhile, Canada, as we mentioned, has been sending representatives to the United States trying to tell people, don't come. What's the message and who exactly are they trying to convince that Canada isn't the place for them?
I don't think that Canada is not the place for them. What they're trying to tell them is that unless they really can prove that they're convention refugees or people in need of protection, because of our international obligations, they will be allowed to come in, they will be allowed to make a refugee claim, but only a small percentage of the people coming in will be deemed to be a convention refugee or a protected person and then able to apply for permanent resident status. The rest, the people that are not accepted as refugees, will end up with a deportation order and will find themselves in the same situation that they find themselves now in the United States. And I think that's what the government is trying to do. In my estimation, they're not doing enough because, fine, they are explaining to people what the process is and what the outcome might be. But I think they should be going a little bit further and they should be explaining what other alternatives there are to making a refugee claim. And I also think that perhaps our government should be relaxing the rules for temporary workers and students, people that want to come under those programs and that they would qualify so that, you know, they have another avenue by which they could eventually obtain permanent residency in Canada.
Vilma, let me ask you about another class of potential immigrants to Canada. Every single election in this country, you hear people say, if the person I don't like manages to get elected or reelected, I'm moving to Canada. I confess, I've never actually seen anyone follow through on this threat. But if it were happening, I suppose you'd be in a position to see it. Have you seen that recently?
Well, I haven't had any clients that were disillusioned with the administration and they wanted to come to Canada. But I have heard of at least two couples that actually applied for permanent residency because they don't like what is happening in the United States, and they became permanent residents in Nova Scotia, one of the Atlantic provinces. So I know that some people are actually following through with what they said election night. I personally haven't had any clients, but I know it's happening.
But the bottom line here, Canada has a reputation for being a very welcoming place to immigrants, to refugees. It's a reputation it's very fond of advertising on the world stage. Is it living up to that reputation now, in your view?
I think it is, because when Canada talks about welcoming the displaced and the people that the refugees, just like the tweet from our prime minister last year, we're talking about legitimate refugees, people that can meet the definition of what a convention refugee is or a person in need of protection, because we have two different programs in Canada. And there is a process. It doesn't mean that anybody that comes to our borders and makes a refugee claim and is allowed to present their case before the board will automatically be allowed to stay in Canada.
Vilma Felici of Felici Palacio Immigration Services in Toronto, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me. Bye-bye.
House Republicans' memo on the FBI, the one the president says could be helpful in undermining the Mueller investigation, is out. The memo claims political bias in the FBI and the Justice Department and charges that law enforcement officials used political information when they sought surveillance on Trump advisor Carter Page, but didn't tell the FISA court the information could be biased. The House Republicans releasing the memo have been accused themselves of selectively cherry-picking information to undermine the FBI and the DOJ. What we don't know was what Republicans see as partisan information, the only information the FISA court used to authorize surveillance on Carter Page. How important was it? What other classified information did they have? Not known. Law enforcement officials appointed by the president, meanwhile, including the director of the FBI, warn publicly that the memo has material facts omitted from it, that it's inaccurate, and that releasing it causes grave concerns. Still, House Speaker Paul Ryan on Thursday said this is how Congress, under his watch, is supposed to work.
What this memo is Congress doing its job in conducting legitimate oversight over a very unique law, FISA. What this is not is an indictment on our institutions, of our justice system.
That's Paul Ryan on Thursday. The president, meanwhile, has reportedly told allies that the memo should slow down Robert Mueller's special counsel investigation. Asked today in the Oval Office whether he has confidence in Rod Rosenstein, the deputy attorney general, and the only man who can fire Bob Mueller, The president said,
"You figure that one out."
We'll try to figure that one out. Betsy Woodruff is political reporter for The Daily Beast, and she's been following the story from the beginning.
The tension between President Trump and members of his own administration, it's really extraordinary. And it's not just FBI Director Chris Wray, who Trump appointed after firing James Comey, who is taking an opposite position on this particular issue from Trump. So it's really driven a wedge, you know, not just between Republicans and Democrats, not just between Republicans in Congress and the FBI. It's driven a wedge between President Trump and some of the most powerful members of his own administration.
So, Betsy, the president tweets this morning that the top leadership and investigators of the FBI and the Justice Department have politicized the investigative process, essentially pro-Democrat and against Trump. And it's easy to forget that it was about 10 days before the election in 2016 when the FBI revealed publicly that they had reopened the investigation into Hillary Clinton's emails.
Right. And over the course of the election, the leaks that came out of the FBI, you know, the preponderance of those leaks were damaging to Hillary Clinton rather than to Donald Trump. So the implication here is not that the FBI should have floated damaging information about Trump, but rather, you know, what's important to understand is that these law enforcement matters are extremely sensitive and in many cases also extremely complicated. Now, it's important to remember also that the FBI is not immune to criticism. You know, I'm sure folks are familiar with the incredible, you know, malpractice the FBI committed during the civil rights movement, you know, targeting civil rights leaders here in the United States. That's something James Comey brings up on a regular basis. It's important not to fall into this mindset that anyone criticizing the FBI or anyone suggesting that there could be political motivations informing its actions is necessarily a partisan hack. In this case, what we're seeing is the president, you know, without evidence, just going hard after the folks who lead this institution.
Well, oversight of the FBI, Betsy, is critical. And we heard from Paul Ryan at the top. He said this is legitimate congressional oversight, the Nunes memo. But if it is, a lot of people are questioning why Devin Nunes won't answer whether he's coordinated, discussed, colluded with the White House over the release of this memo or the information in it.
Right. On Monday evening, the House Intelligence Committee, which put together this memo, well, Republicans on the committee put together this memo, the committee had a meeting. And in that meeting, Mike Quigley, who's a Democratic member of Congress from Illinois, pressed Devin Nunes on a really important question. He said, "Can you guarantee that your staffers didn't coordinate or communicate or work with the White House when they were putting together this memo?" And Nunes refused to answer the question. And there are a number of other indicators or facts that have, you know, observers really concerned that this memo was produced, you know, not for legitimate oversight, but rather as a bad faith attack on the FBI. One fact is that the Democrats on the House Intelligence Committee have put together a counter memo based on the same intelligence that Nunes' memo is built on, but with very different conclusions. And Nunes has not let Democrats release the memo that they have put together. Additionally, Nunes said in that Monday evening meeting of the committee that the committee was actually investigating the FBI rather than, or in addition to, investigating potential coordination between Trump's campaign allies and the Kremlin. The fact that Nunes sort of pulled this FBI investigation out of a hat is a dramatic break from the way the Intelligence Committee in the House is supposed to work. When the Intelligence Committee starts an investigation, it's clearly delineated. They say, here's what we're focusing on. Here are the limits of the investigation. And it's something that the Republicans and the Democrats agree on together. It's a formal process. That process did not take place for the investigation that Nunes announced on Monday of the FBI itself. The fact that Nunes and committee Republicans seem to be freelancing and going after the FBI also just highlights the reason that so many folks are concerned that this is essentially a partisan hack job rather than a good faith effort at doing serious oversight.
Betsy, remind us a little bit about Congressman Nunes's history.
Right. As a little bit of context, you know, Nunes heads the House Intelligence Committee. This committee historically is very low profile. It's very bipartisan. But when Trump became president and then when he tweeted that Obama had wiretapped Trump Tower, Nunes started engaging in activity that was, for folks in the intelligence community, was totally bizarre. And sort of the height of that was in March when he made this midnight trip to the White House, gave a press conference, started talking about how a whistleblower in the intelligence community had given him sensitive intelligence that proved that something really bad had happened. He lied about this to Bloomberg in an interview with Eli Lake, and then subsequently it became known that the quote-unquote whistleblower had been a White House official, that folks at the White House had essentially fed Nunes material in an effort, or in an apparent effort, to retroactively prove or provide evidence to back up the president's tweet. You know, after that happened, the House Ethics Committee started investigating Nunes under concerns that he was acting in a partisan way on this. And then Nunes took a big step back from the Intelligence Committee's investigation of the Russia probe. But Nunes's staffers kept as active of a role as ever in that investigation. And this memo that we're seeing is much more the fruit of work of his staffers than it is the fruit of the work of Nunes himself. Another thing that's important to know about Nunes, and this is something that I picked up in a conversation yesterday with a former Justice Department official, is that he was sort of an unusual pick to be someone to head the Intelligence Committee. And when Boehner named him as House Intelligence Chairman back in 2014, it caused, you know, significant concerns in D.C.'s national security law circles. The reason for that is because Nunes was not viewed as a heavyweight, as sort of a big thinker on intelligence matters. So folks assumed that he would be largely staff-driven. Additionally, another reason that folks were concerned years ago was because Nunes was viewed as somebody who sought the limelight, somebody who really liked having a very visible media presence. And that's the opposite of what you want out of someone doing intelligence oversight, because when you're doing oversight of the intelligence community, it involves lots of classified matters that you can't talk about with reporters. But Nunes seemed to be someone who enjoyed being in the press. So these concerns about Nunes are not new. These are concerns that have existed for years now, and for some folks in the national security space, Nunes's response to the president's tweets about Trump Tower and then to the way that Nunes has handled this memo feels like the culmination of long-term concerns rather than like something that just came out of nowhere.
Meanwhile, Betsy, it can be easy to forget in this whole discussion about a memo and Congressman Nunes and Rod Rosenstein and everything else that the real story is Robert Mueller and the special counsel investigation into possible obstruction of justice or collusion with Russians. That investigation goes on unperturbed.
Right, exactly. You know, at least thus far, we haven't seen the president take action to fire Mueller or to keep his team from doing the work that they're doing. However, we also know that in the past few weeks, Mueller has, you know, taken steps that put him increasingly close to the president's inner circle. Particularly, he's going to be interviewing Mark Corallo, a former spokesperson for the president's legal team. Corallo had a very acrimonious, backstabbing relationship with the Hope Hicks, Ivanka Trump, and Jared Kushner. It's extremely likely that Corallo is going to share information with Mueller that will be damaging to those three people. It's also likely that President Trump is aware of this, and that the fact that Corallo is speaking with Mueller is something that concerns him. Now, does that mean the president's going to take action to try to hobble the Mueller probe? We just don't know, but we do know that when investigators start getting close to Trump's family, he sometimes engages in behavior that is unpredictable. So this is a situation where we just have to wait and see.
Betsy Woodruff, political reporter for The Daily Beast. As always, Betsy, thanks so much.
Sure thing.
Kill them all. Let the paramedics sort them out.
Titans is going to be powered by soul power.
Run again. Get out.
I can do it, coach.
What the hell's a triad?
Triad, you half a meatball.
Let me tell you people something. This ain't just a football. It's your life.
Sounds from the gridiron for this Friday movie roundup with Rafer Guzman, film critic for Newsday, and The Takeaway. Hey, Rafer.
Hey, Todd.
I hear a lot of football there. This is Super Bowl weekend coming up. There's not a lot of new movies coming out because everybody's glued to the ads and also the football game.
That's right.
Coming up this weekend. So you're here with your top football movies of all time.
That's right. Personal picks, at least.
Rafer's personal picks. We're going to get to those. I have some trivia for you, by the way. Don't answer now, Rafer. You're going to hold on to your answer as you always do. Listeners, if you know it, you can hit me on Twitter. We have a football-styled movie segment today. Rafer, here's your question. What NFL star made Ben Stiller really, really jealous in There's Something About Mary? That's your question. Think about it. Now, let's go to your top football movies of all time. For the first one, you're going back to 1974.
So no matter what happens, just keep sticking it to him. Now, who are we?
Did I hear The Longest Yard with Burt Reynolds there?
Yes, indeed. He plays Paul Crewe, Paul the Wrecking Crewe, former ball player, sent to prison for a short stint. But it turns out that the warden, who's not only a sadist, of course, is also a football fan, played by the great Eddie Albert. He wants Paul Crewe to lead a football game of the prisoners against the guards. And I think what I like about this movie is that even though I think technically you would call it a comedy, it is a hard R movie and it plays rough. There is violence and there is death, and the game looks brutal, and I love that about it. And I think that final play in the movie, 6 seconds stretched out to 90 seconds of slow motion, is one of the best things I've ever seen.
That's a classic by this point, 1974. Take you back to the Nixon era in The Longest Yard. Now, your second pick is from the modern era. This is Draft Day.
What are you doing, Sonny?
Just made a trade with the Seahawks.
For?
The number one pick.
I confess I haven't seen Draft Day, but I think I hear the dulcet tones of Kevin Costner there.
That is correct. You're not alone. Almost nobody saw Draft Day in 2014. Costner plays Sonny Weaver. He's the general manager of the Cleveland Browns. He's been offered on Draft Day for a steep price to get the reigning college pick, a guy named Bo Callahan, but he's not sure he wants it. Something smells wrong about this deal, and he spends the day trying to figure out what. I think this movie is really good because Kevin Costner is so great in it. You really believe him.
Yeah, Kevin Costner, okay.
Yeah, you're not a Kevin Costner fan.
I am not.
All right, this might not be the right pick for you. It is also a deeply flawed movie, and I would say that probably the more you know about football, the more you will find to complain about it. But I thought it was actually quite entertaining. It's directed by Ivan Reitman, who did Ghostbusters. It's got a lot of snazz and pizzazz to it, and I really enjoyed it.
All right, let's go to your number three. Oh, what is this I see on my list? I'm going to play this clip. Vince, hit it. Go ahead.
Bobby, where was the intensity that I saw yesterday?
That wasn't no intensity. You said it was all right to fight back, and I just started thinking about all the people who've been mean to me over the years.
That's it.
Rafer, Waterboy?
That's
really
the Waterboy.
Are you bringing Adam Sandler on this show?
You know, everybody always wants me to defend the Waterboy. Whenever I bring it up, I have to apologize for liking this movie. I know what you're saying, Todd. That's Adam Sandler. He plays Bobby Boucher, a fairly offensive stereotype on every level. He's a stuttering, mentally impaired Cajun. He's also the water carrier for a college football team called the Mud Dogs. That's Henry Winkler as his coach, who discovers that Bobby has a gift for tackling people.
Yeah.
And this movie cracks me up. You couldn't make it today, especially since half the jokes are about football concussions, but I think if you can kind of put yourself back in that 1998 mindset, I think it's just a funny, crude, stupid, great comedy.
And when you were in your 1998 mindset, it was when Adam Sandler was funny, right?
That's right. You got
to
savor those Adam Sandler moments when he's good, you know.
That is Waterboy from Rafer Guzman. Rafer, I had some football trivia for you before we go. I asked you what NFL star made Ben Stiller really, really jealous in There's Something About Mary.
Todd, I'm drawing a blank. I'm stumped. I'm sorry. I like that movie, too.
The answer is?
Brett?
What the hell is Brett Favre doing here?
Brett Favre.
Sorry, Todd. I let you down.
Cameron Diaz there. Rafer Guzman, film critic for Newsday. It's The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, and it's Friday. Does that make you happy? Well, if it does, hold on to that feeling, because over the course of the next month, we're teaming up with The Science of Happiness. It's a new podcast co-produced by the UC Berkeley's Greater Good Science Center and PRI. Dacher Keltner is the host of The Science of Happiness. It's a podcast that looks at tools for living a happier, more meaningful life. But don't worry, Dacher Keltner says this is not a podcast from the typical self-help section.
It's this really fascinating combination of the qualitative and the quantitative. And we kind of synthesize the experiential with data and science.
I want to be honest for a second. I have a neuroscience background myself from my college days before journalism. The prospect of using brain science and really being able to examine how the brain responds to measures of happiness appeals to me a lot. I'm the guy, like so many others, Dackner, over the years, when you hear about self-help, 7 habits, 9 things you can do to achieve bliss, I roll my eyes.
I do too. But for me, the game changer is the neurophysiology. Darwin said sympathy is our strongest instinct. Only now are we starting to formulate an evolutionary argument for why it matters to be sympathetic, and that's because our offspring takes 7 to 49 years to become independent. So we need to take care of those carriers of our genes. But here's what's striking. What neuroscientists are finding is that the brain rewards us for being good.
Now, you talk about the science of happiness. Talk a little bit about the neuroscience of happiness. I don't want to be too reductionist about it, but I know you have some. Happiness isn't just one thing, but give me an example of where we just know how the brain reacts to certain kinds of exercises that can make you happier.
Neuroscience has found that a very old part of the mammalian brain, the periaqueductal gray, is activated in compassion. And then compassion activates the vagus nerve, which is the largest bundle of nerves in your body. And it really helps you do things to be kind, like look at people in the eyes, vocalize, slow your heart rate down. And not only that, but the vagus nerve is regulating your immune system response. So what we're learning is compassion alters very fundamental branches of your nervous system that help you be healthy.
Well, this is reminding me in so many ways of some of the parts of my neuroscience background, Dr. that I found the most interesting. Look, I have you here, host prerogative. can I get in on this? Do you think I could sign up? I don't know if you have any more slots for guinea pigs, but can I get some?
Man, all right. We'll take you on as a guinea pig. Definitely. No, we'd love, and in fact, we'd love to have you repeat as a guinea pig. We will treat you better than the neuroscientists sometimes treat guinea pigs. So, no, we'll welcome it.
Well, let me put out the call to takeaway listeners here, because Dacher Keltner is on the hunt for happiness guinea pigs anywhere he can find them. So if you're listening, why don't you play along? Become a happiness guinea pig yourself in the 3 good things exercise. And we'll talk more about it next week on the program. Right, Dacher?
Yeah. You know, I love that. The 3 good things practice, which is where you just take a moment and you just think about 3 good things in your life. And you may be really working hard and overtaxed, but you just take a couple of minutes, 15 minutes, and you write it down, you name it, you think about the origins of those good things and what it means to your life. It kind of shifts the mind out of the list-making mode and the what's threatening out there mode to what can I appreciate? And what we know scientifically is 3 good things, like a lot of these practices, kind of produces feelings of appreciation. It slows time down. Sometimes studies show it benefits your body. So it's really a revealing guinea pig exercise.
That's great. So go to our show page at thetakeaway.org, where you can find instructions for the 3 good things practice. Try it out. Give us a call at 8778-MY-TAKE and tell us how it went. We might play your comment when Dacher comes back next week. Dacher Keltner is professor of psychology at UC Berkeley. He's director of Berkeley's Greater Good Science Center and the host of the new podcast, The Science of Happiness, co-produced by the Greater Good Science Center and PRI. It's award season in America. We've seen the Golden Globes, the Grammys just went off, and the Oscars are coming up in just a few weeks. When you think of coverage of those awards, you might think of reporters waiting breathlessly just off the red carpet, where the question is always, who are you wearing? But Coa Beck and Jessica Bennett say, in the Me Too era, that's no longer enough. Every week we hear from Coa, editor-in-chief of Jezebel, and Jessica, gender editor for the New York Times. And this week they ask, how are news outlets covering the awards this year, and what can be done better? Jessica Bennett says the New York Times tried one way of making a change.
Our style section, which, you know, always sends reporters to cover it. We cover fashion. We cover it from the entertainment angle. We send photographers. We wanted to do something different this year, and so instead of sending our usual entertainment photographers, we sent Damon Winter, who is a Pulitzer Prize-winning photojournalist who covers politics, to actually cover the red carpet. And so I was highly conscious watching, and this was the Golden Globes, you know, whether the journalistic methods and the reporting methods would actually change on the red carpet, because certainly some of the photography was shifting, or at least we were trying to shift it. But you still saw a lot of the same sort of shallow questioning. Like, even if it was asking about Me Too, it was asking the same question over and over again, followed by what are you wearing or who are you wearing?
During the Golden Globes specifically, Jezebel had a video where we actually did a supercut of a lot of red carpet footage in which specifically male broadcast journalists cut off women as they were elaborating on Time's Up and Me Too.
Right. Well, Amanda Hess, who's a critic in the culture section of the Times, wrote this great piece about basically what happened on the red carpet. But she mentions this moment where Tarana Burke, the creator of Me Too, is elaborating exactly what you're saying. She's elaborating on the movement, and whichever network was showing it literally zoomed out and made it a tiny little square in the bottom left-hand corner of the screen. So it was literally like she was an accessory to the celebrity.
Mm-hmm. I think what this underscores is that, one, we need more journalists in the space who can talk about this and who can interview, whether it's people in entertainment or other industries, about sexual harassment and sexual violence. What we're seeing in real time is that we don't have that. And so,
like, Carson Daly, maybe not the best choice.
Not everybody has the skill set to report on this. And another thing that the staff and I have been commenting on and talking about a lot internally is that we're now seeing, like, routine press interviews for movies with actresses, given the climate. Interviewers just sort of slide in with, like, so have you ever been sexually assaulted? And you, I mean, that's such a deeply offensive and horrific thing to ask somebody without any sort of indication that you will be asking that. And to just slide that in casually amidst, like, well, tell me about this role and tell me about this film. And it's not a fluffy question to ask someone. And just because it's very topical in our culture right now doesn't mean that you're entitled to survivors' stories. Having said that, if they want to share them, there is a protocol for that that follows, you know, certain avenues of trust and articulating what's happened to you. But reporters in the space cannot just ad hoc this. I think also another thing that we're seeing that overlaps really cleanly with this too is that in a post-Weinstein landscape where you have allegations within entertainment being read widely, a lot of entertainment desks have now become sexual harassment desks by virtue of demand, which is irksome because, one, not everyone can just do this reporting and do it well, which I think you saw very clearly with the Babe Aziz Ansari story. Not everyone can just wade into this and accurately report sexual harassment, sexual violence.
This harkens back a bit to the conversation we had a few weeks ago about how do you cover this? Because I do feel like there is a lack of industry-wide training or understanding about how you deal with such sensitive topics and what is the appropriate way to ask these questions. Why is trust important? Because we have these guides for covering all sorts of other things, but we don't have one as it exists for covering sexual assault.
Jessica, what would be the call out from you to journalists who are covering red carpets and awards?
I actually think it would be fascinating if institutions decided to send reporters who are not necessarily entertainment journalists, which isn't to say that there aren't amazing entertainment journalists out there, but, you know, what if you had an investigative reporter who covered Hollywood asking the questions? You know, in our case, Jodi Kantor and Megan Toohey were on that story for 6 to 8 months. They've continued to cover it. I would be fascinated to hear what they would ask people on the red carpet. And I think more broadly, treating the red carpet as you would anything else. It's weird that the red carpet is this space where we can just ask these very superficial, fluffy questions, whereas in every other context, journalists are held to this bar of seriousness.
Okay. In real time, reporter workshop. Ready?
Okay. Ready.
Okay. So you and I are on a red carpet reporting Me Too. How would we approach a talent who is coming towards us to accurately report on this moment?
I mean, I actually think we would approach it the way we approach any other subject. Like when I'm interviewing someone, I do research. I read up on what they've been working on. I read up on where they came from. I read up on things that they've said in the past. And I try to pull out the most interesting threads. Clearly, they're here for a reason. We need to ask them about their film. But can we just ask them questions of interest that don't necessarily focus on what they're wearing? And as far as Me Too, I want to know what brought them to this. I want to know what their message is. I don't just want to know whether or not they're wearing a Time's Up pin. I want to know what Time's Up means to them.
One of the things I would do personally on the red carpet that we have not seen is that I would approach male talent and ask them about sexual harassment, sexual violence.
Yes.
That has been one of our biggest criticisms as a staff, and that once again, the weight has fallen to women to account for this. So I would make a point to approach, let's say, Gary Oldman, because he just got a Golden Globe, and I would ask, have you ever witnessed any sexual harassment on set? Have you ever observed anything and thought maybe you should tell a producer about it or observe something like that? And depending on how far we got in the interview, I would also ask him about the assault allegations against him by his third wife.
And then you'd promptly be hustled off.
I'd promptly be hustled off the red carpet. I think that also harkens back to a different segment in that we are now at a moment in which we are asking people to think more critically about the culture they consume. And if we have events like the Golden Globes and the Grammys that allegedly want to engage in this discourse and authentically engage with it, not just play the optics, then this is a more truthful way to do that. And isn't just about wearing a pin, because anyone can do that.
Yeah.
And I would, in fact, do this.
So
Jessica and I are putting out our shingle. We will cover your red carpet if you are bold enough to have us.
Koa Beck is editor-in-chief of Jezebel, and Jessica Bennett is the gender editor for the New York Times. You can find all of their conversations at thetakeaway.org/MeTooMemos. We leave you on this Friday with a little nostalgia from British soul and R&B singer James Hunter. His new album is called Whatever It Takes. It's out today. British fans are going to be thrilled because James Hunter has a big, big following in the UK.
A tender word too few, came a half a day too late.
He's setting out on his U.S. tour with the James Hunter Six later this month. Hunter says he didn't have a lot of time on his hands for this album, and with a quick turnaround for a dozen original songs, he eked out 10 of them, one of them the night before hitting the studio.
Well, I spent most of my time trying to write the stuff, really. Apparently, I write better under pressure, so they put me under a lot of it. They gave me a small window to write 10 songs.
Nail your colors to the mast and have a little faith in me. I don't give up so fast if there's one thing you can say for me.
Do you find that kind of pressure just helps it pour out of you without overthinking it? Just, you know, you sort of open up the floodgates and you get good stuff?
It varies with me. Sometimes under a bit of pressure, I can turn out the goods.
Leave the struggle in the past and have a little faith in me.
James Hunter, how did you grow up? Tell me what home was like.
Well, I grew up on a council estate in Colchester, Essex, which is about 50 miles northeast of London, in East Anglia.
A council estate, yeah. For American listeners, that's the housing projects.
That is the projects, yes. It's probably not as scary as some of your projects you got over there, but it depends on your standpoint.
So on the council estates as a young kid, 9 or 10, what were you listening to?
Everything seemed to be children's records. It all sounded like, you know, you never heard Frank Zappa when you were in Colchester. It was all The Scaffold and stuff like that. And it always seemed to me, like Whistling Jack Smith, there always seemed to be quite a lot of daft novelty stuff. But you did hear a little bit of Motown, even though I didn't know what it was at the time.
Well, when did you make the turn then from the novelty kind of cutesy songs that were the mark in the late 60s to closer to the type of stuff that you like to do today?
Well, I discovered it all by accident because we'd emigrated to Australia and we came back 2 years later and we were living in a caravan and we were a bit stuck for entertainment. We were in an onion field in Thorrington and our grandmother gave us a dance set and a bunch of 78s. And there was one R&B gem in there, Reet Petite by Jackie Wilson, which I'm given to understand wasn't a very big hit when it was released in the States. I've used that story and it it wasn't really how I got into that sort of music, but it was the nearest marker I could find that, you know, to as a starting point. And I think there wasn't one. I think it just gradually seeped into me.
I mean, you'd been in the music business for a while already, but I wonder the point where you figured out, you know, what your voice was and that it was really just, you know, this American black music.
I sort of pretty much found most of my voice was trying to duplicate what I heard. And I suppose the nearest thing to my own voice in a way was through the lyrics, really. I had to try to write something that distinguishes itself from being just a copyist. Something a little bit more sardonic, you know, with a slight more British sensibility, but keeping the feel of the American stuff. An evil mind will always find work for idle hands. But don't worry none, because while you're gone, I ain't forgetting that I'm your man. I got eyes for nobody but you. I got eyes for nobody but you.
I mean, James, does that mean that there's, you know, if you're a white artist doing black music, that there's sort of a latent charge of mimicry that comes from audiences, potentially? You hear that sometimes, in America at least.
I mean, I've never been accused of it, but if I was, I'd sheepishly put my hand up to it and admit it, yes. I totally based my style on other people's initially and then tried to extend it past that.
Well, I want to listen to a track called How Long?
My baby took a powder on one fine September day. My crying grew louder as her footsteps faded away. In her wake lay shattered fragments of the smile I used to wear. How long will it take for my poor heart to repair?
James, is that a bad breakup? Is that grief?
No, that's just because there's three different things happen in the song. First, the romantic heartbreak is all dealt with in the first verse, and then it's more of a catalogue of misfortune. I mean, loses his money on a horse in the next verse. Third verse, he dies, tries to get into heaven, and gets kicked out before he gets past the gate. So it's just basically an everything gone wrong song, because that kind of thing, I can't really find humour in romantic situations. So, you know, you can't laugh at somebody stepping past a banana skin, can you?
All right, well, let's deal with something maybe a little happier for James Hunter walking past the banana peel. This is I Don't Want to Be Without You.
When we met, I was pretty well set in my ways. I didn't care how or where I spent my day. But now that all has changed, I never wanna be the same. Love you so that all I know is I don't wanna be without you, baby.
Oh, that feels nice, James Hunter.
It's more like it, isn't it?
I might think that you were a guy in a new relationship, but again, I don't know if it's autobiographical.
Well, it's been going on for months now, so I wouldn't call it new, but I've got to be careful what I say because I brought her into the studio with me and she's
she's
wielding a chair leg, so I've got to make sure I convey that, you know, the song was entirely written with her in mind.
So you're on a new label, you're on Daptone, independent soul label based in Brooklyn here in New York City. American audiences, look, this is American music done by a British guy. You like American audiences? I mean, don't flatter them too much, but what do you think when you come over here and play in front of these trained ears?
I do like playing to Yanks because they're up for it. You know what I mean? They don't have our reserved, standoffish kind of thing that we've perfected over here. America's a place where they like to say yes rather than no, and they can be much more open and enthusiastic over there.
The new album is Whatever It Takes, all originals. No standards. Hey, it was supposed to be 12. James Hunter gave them 10, but 10 high-quality songs from R&B artist James Hunter. Hey, thanks for talking to us.
Thank you very much, Todd. Nice to meet you.
Well, that's all for the podcast and for us at the end of this week on this Friday on The Takeaway. Hey, if you haven't already, subscribe to the podcast on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. And hey, while you're there, make sure to leave a comment or a rating. In the meantime, enjoy your weekend, everyone, and thanks for joining us. I'm Todd Zwillick. This is The Takeaway.
Want more information about the stories you hear on The Takeaway? Check out thetakeaway.org for more facts, figures, and news from guests and contributors and opinions from your fellow listeners. Leave us a note or comment on a story you heard, all at thetakeaway.org.